Well, without further ado, let's get started on this. Harry, are you with us? Harry Compton. We'll go check on him in a second.
Do you want me to start?
Sure, Sally, if that's okay with you, please.
Yeah. So welcome, and it's been a pleasure doing this course at the different OSC and RPM training periods. It's going to be strange for me not to be able to look and see who's nodding off and who's smiling brightly, but I'll do my best here. Oh, and then Harry is back, so Harry, do you want to take over or do you want me to go? No, okay. I will start. What we want to talk about here is ecological restoration starting literally from the ground up, because not just because I've been officially trained as a soil scientist, but because on many of the sites that you guys have to work on, you're talking about trying to rebuild a functional ecosystem with your mainstay, your basic medium for that ecosystem having been drastically disturbed. We'll use different sites as examples, and the sites that we're talking about are large-scale mining sites with very heavy metal contamination. But in a wide range of sites, from landfill covers to urban areas that need to be restored, former steel slag sites, any number of sites that you're coming into, the soil has been very disturbed either through the prior use or through the cleanup that you've had to go through to fix the site. And in order for the site to be restored to a functioning ecosystem, you need to start by having a soil that can support that system. And so if you go to the second slide, you can see, and Harry, please tell me if you're there or you want to talk.
I'm on board. I had a little technical difficulty.
But what a guy. He's right on it now. Do you want to take over the beginning now?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, no, you did a great job.
And make sure, Harry, sorry to interrupt, but make sure you speak up, all right?
Oh, okay. Is that better?
Much better.
Okay. Just one other thing I wanted to add to that first slide is it's a lot, many people and a lot of hard work went into this whole concept here, so it's not just Sally and Harry. I mean, there were lots of other scientists involved, and I just wanted to give a plug for all those folks out there. But anyway, on to slide two. And my point of this slide is, this was taken from a site in Florida that I had worked on one time. And we had, by the end of the project, they had excavated, I think, about 250,000 cubic yards of soil. And my point is that we're, EPA, just because of cost and efficiency and other, well, lots of other logical reasons, we're kind of moving away from the dig-and-haul kinds of projects now, there's a lot of good reasons we're doing that, and we need to look at more creative ways to solve a problem. And so that's the sole point of this slide, is that EPA, for lots of different reasons, are moving away from large excavation kinds of projects, and we need to think more creatively about how to solve the problem or crack the nut for some of these large area sites, such as mining sites.
And can I interject here? One thing to realize is dig and haul had been the paradigm of the past. What we're talking about as an alternative, it can be cheaper, but that doesn't mean that it's worse. In fact, in many cases, it can be less destructive environmentally than a dig and haul approach. Okay, that was all I wanted to say.
All right, on to slide number three. And I wanted to point out how, from EPA's perspective, how for the site managers, it dovetails into OSWR priorities of revitalization, recycling, and the one cleanup program. For the revitalization aspect of it, I don't know if many of you are familiar with EPA, we have our performance evaluation system, the PARS, and you may realize that land revitalization is a key element or goal in our agency right now. It's a priority. And so we're revitalizing the land via this kind of eco-restoration technique. And it's also recycling. We're taking different residuals, different waste materials, combining them together to make a good product, a good creative habitat. for land reuse. So we're actually recycling waste materials. And then at one point we had, well, had a lot more energy when Marianne Lamont Marinko was our AA, but right now the One Cleanup program. So it reaches across more than just Superfund. It reaches across lots of cleanup programs, including brownfields and RECRA. So it's applicable to lots of different cleanup programs. All right, moving on to slide number 4. I think this is where I'll turn it over to Sally and let her pick it up from here.
Everybody likes looking at pictures, and how better to prove a point than through ugly and pretty pictures. This was one of the first sites that Harry and I worked on, and as Harry pointed out before, it was by no means Harry and I. We were small players that get to do the phone talk. Rufus Cheney from USDA was one of the major players, the Northwest Biosolids Management Association, people from Region 10, Scott Fredericks. There was a whole range of people involved in this project. Bunker Hill, and you can't show hands here, but I would imagine a number of you are familiar with the site. It's a large mining and smelting site in northern Idaho that has a upland component as well as a wetland component. And here we're just showing what we're talking about in terms of the kind of results that you can get with the upland component here. This is mine tailings that you can see on a steep slope, very high lead, zinc, cad, also high. There's arsenic in there if you look for it. Very poor physical properties. And in the lower picture, you can see that we're using a fancy piece of Swiss logging equipment that has been retrofitted and can take a combination. Here we're using municipal biosolids and wood ash and spreading it on a surface application on the hillside. And if you go to the next picture, you can see pretty clearly the areas that were treated versus the areas that weren't treated. In the lower picture, that line of treated versus untreated is hard to miss. So the point here is using residuals even on these very, very difficult sites, you can get results that would make anyone proud. Is that a good summation, Harry? Harry, listen to me.
Yes.
Oh, thank you, Harry. pardon me for giggling. If you move on to the next site, and if you hear focus on mine sites, but if you take almost, I can't say all of the sites, but a vast majority of sites that fall under the Superfund program or fall under a need to be restored, if you're looking at a bare soil surface, in many cases that lack of vegetation has there's a bunch of things holding back the plants from growing, and even if you do have some plant growth, there are things that are holding back the plants from growing well and as vigorously as they could. And on a lot of these soils, if you just take a standard fertilizer application, putting down some nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, it's not going to do it for you. You'll get some growth that'll die back as soon as that fertilizer is exhausted. What you're dealing with at these sites is a combination of very low native fertility. So it's like trying to grow something on smashed up concrete, not a very good growth medium. In addition to the low fertility, you have problems with the physical properties. If you've tried to grow something on sand, you know how long it takes for that sand to get dried out after you water it, about half an hour. This is also true for many soils in New Jersey. And
two more activities I know of.
Wait, is somebody talking to me here? Or is that a background? Okay. Another problem at a lot of these sites can be that either the soil is too acid, and acid is what I wrote down here, the pH is too low. You can also have problems with some of these sites where the pH is too high. At the mine sites we've looked at, metal toxicities can be a problem. This can also be a problem in urban areas or other types of industrial sites, brownfield sites, such as steel mill sites can have metal problems. And finally, in the case where your pH is too high, very often you can have salt problems, excess salts in the soil. Okay, and if you go on to the next site, next slide, which is slide number 7. So when you're coming into these sites, what you want to do is address each of those problems. When your site has contaminants, and this is true of either organic or inorganic, the metals, what you want to do if you're looking at an alternative to dig and haul is to potentially leave the contamination in place but reduce the danger or the bioavailability of the contaminant. So it's like taking your money that's in your wallet that you can spend right away, it's readily bioavailable, and locking it up in a retirement account where you get severely penalized if you take it out before you're 95. You want to take those contaminants that are readily available and lock them away, and in many cases a soil amendment can help you do that. In addition to reducing the bioavailability of the contaminant, what you want to do is build a functional soil on top of it, either by creating a whole new soil horizon or by giving the soil that is there a big-time facelift or weak at the spa, so to speak. You want to make it so it's a healthy soil again. And once it's a healthy soil, you start seeing the normal soil functions coming back. You're able to sustain plant growth, and you're able to sustain soil fertility. You do this by having an active microbial population in the soil so that the nutrients that you've added can be recycled and reused by plants. And ideally, if you've done this well, what you can do is establish a native plant ecosystem, which instead of a field of tulips, for those that have heard Steve Handel talk, a native plant system will come back year after year. There'll be changes, there'll be evolution, but it's not something that's going to require a lot of management on your end. And now, if we go to slide number 8. Now, what Harry and I have been involved with, along with all the other people that we've worked with, is doing this through the use of residuals, with the approach that a pile is our friend. Things generated by other activities, making sugar, making timber, cleaning wastewater, all these activities have their one primary goal, but what happens as a result of that goal is they produce other material. And that material to that particular industry can be a residual, but to you as a restoration manager can be an incredible resource. Because it's a residual, to the industry that's producing it, it can be available to you at either a very reduced cost or potentially at no cost. In addition to that, by using these residuals, what you're doing is following the grand goal of EPA and doing something that's very environmentally sound. You're recycling a material that in one case is a waste, but you're turning it into a resource. By using residuals, what you can also do is you can tap into potentially very large amounts of material. So if you're trying to deal with a site that's not an acre, but rather 500 acres or 50 acres, you can deal with that site in a cost-effective way. You can rebuild the soil using residuals for a small fraction of the cost of purchasing new topsoil. And what finally you can do is, in many cases, if you work with the companies or the municipalities, public agencies that generate these residuals, in a lot of cases, they have experience using the residuals. They'll have application equipment like that logger we saw way back in slide number 3 or 4, I believe, the logging equipment, that six-wheel drive Rotney. And in many cases, this equipment can be available for your use, and that can reduce your headaches as well as improve your bottom line. Okay, we can go to the next slide. And it's really strange not to have instant feedback here. So, Harry, could you say something? Did I miss anything or anything?
You're on a roll.
Okay. Now, I taught a class recently, and it was an introductory class here at the university. We had a lot of the football team, and they're not doing well either in the classroom or on the field this year, but there's always hope for the future. And I was talking about biosolids, and I asked them, Okay. How many of you guys have flushed the toilet today? And only about half of them raised their hands, and I'm taking this passes at 1:30 in the afternoon. These guys are having real problems. But I offered them an option that maybe they ought to leave the room right now because they were going to burst if they didn't. But anyone that has flushed the toilet, washed the dish, taken a shower, has made a wonderful contribution to the availability of the resource that is called biosolids. Biosolids are the solid material that comes from wastewater treatment. And wastewater treatment is something that got a whole lot more money put into it and got a lot more sophisticated with the passage of the Clean Water Act. With the Clean Water Act, you got a lot of funding available to improve wastewater treatment facilities, to construct wastewater treatment facilities, and as a result of that, the amount of biosolids being generated has gone up. So there's a lot of this material around. Anyway, there's a cluster of people, you're going to be able to find biosolids. Biosolids come from a combination of residences and industry, and in the majority of the cities, what you see is a huge percentage of the material comes from people's homes. In Seattle, greater than 95% of the material comes from people's homes. In Washington, D.C., it's less than 0.5% comes from industry. Philadelphia, it's also something like 98% comes from domestic sources. Once it enters the treatment plant, the dirty water that's coming into the plant goes through several treatment stages. Primary treatment, secondary treatment where air is bubbled through and microbes have a feast on your flushings, settling, and then potentially tertiary treatment. In each of these stages, what happens is that solid material settles down to the bottom. In a lot of cases, the solid material is the microbes that have collapsed after their feast. And all the solids get taken to a biosolids treatment or stabilization tank where they're treated to meet EPA requirements for pathogen reduction. EPA, the quality of biosolids that can be used on land is regulated under Part 503, which governs pathogen concentrations and material vector attraction requirements in the material. In other words, you don't want to attract the vectors as well as metal concentrations of material. So biosolids are one of my favorite residual and also readily available, and that's enough on what happens when you flush the toilet. So if you go to slide number 10, a little bit more on the biosolids, take back what I just said, regulated, majority are land applied, and one of the beauties here is rather than something that's being governed or being owned and operated by a private company, the people that run wastewater treatment plants are municipal employees, so there's not allowed to have a profit motive there, and in fact the cost of the mandated to do something with the biosolids, and this is a large portion of your water bill, the cost of what they do with the biosolids. Their beneficial uses of biosolids are recommended under 503 in the state of Washington. You have to have a very good excuse not to beneficially use your biosolids, and the municipality itself is required to pay for this. So if you're coming in and working with a municipality, they're going to have an associated cost, and by offering them a potential end use for their materials, you can also subsidize your bottom line by working with them. They're paying anyway. So there you have that. If we go to slide number 11, another resource that is currently underutilized, and depending on the area of the states where you're working, in the Northwest and the Southeast, pulp and paper is a big industry. And pulp and paper makes a range of materials in addition to pulp and paper that can be very, very useful for restoration. Pulp and paper sludges are a lot like paper mache, or they can be. So if you're working on steep slopes, you take a pulp and paper sludge, mix it with a higher nitrogen material like a manure, and you've got a paper mache that will stick beautifully to a hill slope. You can also have from recycling paper or shiny glossy paper, the residuals associated with that type of activity will tend to have higher clay content, so it can be a really nice material for building a new soil. Secondary pulp and paper solids have much higher nutrient content and can be a wonderful ingredient in a soil mixture. Okay? See how many beautiful types of waste there are out there, and you never even thought about it. If you go on to the next slide, this is number 12, here's just a sprinkling of other materials that can be potentially useful. The sugar beet lime, if you're in Montana, Colorado, there's a whole lot of sugar beet processing, and what they do to purify the sugar is squirt a very fine, I think it's calcium oxide into it, maybe calcium carbonate. Anyway, the residual you get is a fine textured, fairly reactive calcium carbonate. It's beautiful in a soil. We use it in one of the sites that we'll be talking about. Ash. In many cases, wood or organics are burned, and the ash that's left over can be the building block for the mineral portion of the soil that you're trying to create. And just let to know, so that you know, for manures, there's, I think, 100 times more manure produced than biosolids in the U.S. And if you're near a confined animal feeding operation, they would be very happy to talk to you. Concerns with manure is that pathogens haven't been reduced, but on a large-scale site where you have the potential to restrict entry, that can be not a problem. Finally, different types of waste material, like land clearing debris, lumber industry. If you're working with a public utility, like an electric company, in many cases, they do a lot of branch trimming and will have a lot of woody material that can be great for a restoration site. Okay, if we go on, we can see a lovely scarab turner and the lovely former student Pam DeVolder here in two different piles of compost. We're on slide 13 now. Compost is a finished material, so it's got a much more apparent market value. Depending on your site, compost can be a wonderful soil for you. It will be more expensive than the residuals that haven't been composted yet, but depending on your timeline, the size of your site, and the proximity of a lot of people to your site, if you're in the middle of Trenton, New Jersey, compost might be a really good option for you. And there's a range of municipalities that compost their yard waste. There's a range of other industries that make compost from their waste material. Right now in the city of Seattle, there's a big mandate, to take compostable materials out of landfills, and one of the local composting companies got a big contract to compost the solid waste from the city of Seattle. So there's a whole lot of orange peels out there that are waiting to help your site. I'm going to have a sip of water here. Thanks for bearing with me, and let's go to slide number 14. So you have your site. You have all these wonderful kinds of wastes that may be garbage to somebody but can be a resource to you, and then how do you put it together? Well, one of the best things to do to start is to take a look at your site and look at it from a critical point of view and to make sure you know what you're dealing with and also to make sure what's around you, what's available. Just because I said pulp sludge, if you're living in Nevada and you're nowhere near a pulp and paper mill, don't get an idea that pulp sludge is the be-all and end-all from your site. Look at what's locally available, because in moving a lot of materials, transport is going to be one of your major costs. Anyway, you have to design a remedy for your site based on what's gone on there, what kind of problems you're dealing with at the site, and what materials are available to you. And here, Harry is available, I'm available, there are a range of people available to help you in this process if this is a new thing to you. So don't get overwhelmed at this prospect and realize that if you have an acid site, you're going to want some kind of material that has a high calcium carbonate equivalent to lime it, to help it out. If you're in an arid area, you want to be really careful to stay away from a high salt amendment. If you've got problems with metals, you may want to use certain kinds of amendments, like a high iron biosolids compost could be a great thing for you. So if you go through a steps in design, taking into account what's gone on at the site, results from your soil sampling, pH, carbon content, are just a few of the things, total metal concentrations, organic contaminants of concern. Look at where your area is, look at what's available around you, and then come up with a set of appropriate mixtures. That's a great way to start. And now we can go to the next slide, where I'm going to say that I have a slight change here. We're going to focus, instead of on three sites, we're going to focus primarily on the wetland in Bunker Hill, and then in Leadville, Colorado, I'm going to end the class or talk with some information on a site in Missouri rather than Clark Creek. But so we're going to now move into specific areas, starting with the wetland in Bunker Hill and then moving to river deposited tailings in Leadville. The sites that we're going to talk about are all heavily contaminated with metals and have been a huge headache to fix. And if we go to the next slide, Harry, do you want me to keep talking or you want to take over for a while? I don't remember what we had decided.
No, you're doing a great job. I'll pick it up at Cal Gulch unless you...
Okay. Let me tell you about the wetland restoration here in Bunker Hill. You should be on slide number 16 now, and this is climbing up the hillside from behind this wetland. You get a shot of what it used to look like. You can see in the background of the slide, you can see I-90, the interstate highway, and the main hillside portion of the Bunker Hill site, which I have to say look really nice these days, is a little bit to your east, and you're looking down on a wetland. This wetland was used in the 1920s as a tailings repository, and in the 1920s, that was a time when if you were looking for lead ore, if it was 10% lead, it was a nice ore, and if it was 2% lead, it wasn't worth looking at. Way back 100 years ago, our stock of ores was much richer. The metals content in the ores was much higher, and our extraction efficiency for these ores was much poorer. As a result of this, the waste material or the tailings that's left over from mining the material and milling it was very, very severely contaminated. And in the 20s, Richard Nixon hadn't been there, and there was no EPA yet, and it was just a big push to get as much mineral out of the earth as possible. And so here, the tailings were dumped directly into this pre-existing wetland, and lead concentration here was in these materials about 3%, zinc about 1.5%, cadmium about 100 ppm, arsenic was also there. It's not listed here. I don't have a number for arsenic. What happened at the site as part of the initial closure agreement with the industries, the PRPs and EPA, was that EPA asked that the top portion of the site be excavated. And so the surface here was raw tailings material. Further in the distance, you can see a wooded area. Coeur d'Alene has extensive amounts of contaminated wetlands in the site now. And further in the background there is the wastewater treatment facility for the Silver Valley. If you go now to the next slide, number 17, you can see Chuck Henry standing in what you could never call a soil. This is in the center of the wetland that had been excavated. He's standing on tailings material. I wouldn't want to grow in that, and very few things were trying to grow in that. At this particular site, when we were working on the site, our primary goal, we were told, was, or the primary concern here, was to protect wildlife. What was happening to wildlife in the area was they were ingesting a lot of this contaminated sediment and getting acute lead poisoning. Not talking about hunting. You see, your goal as a restoration person at the site is to make their lead poisoning much quicker, coming from the lead shot from the hunter, not any of this eating the sediment stuff. That was supposed to be a joke, and I wish I could hear if anybody was laughing. Anyway, if you go to slide number 18, what happens in this area is that a lot of migratory birds, and they're gorgeous birds, use these wetlands seasonally. They come in to feed and nest in the area, and as part of their eating habit, they dive down for the roots and the tubers. And in addition to roots and tubers, they end up eating quite a bit of sediment. And every year Fish and Wildlife in the area goes around and picks up dead birds, not the ones with the lead shot in them, but the ones that have enough lead in their guts from the sediment that they've been eating that they get acute lead poisoning. And there's about a 100-square-mile area here that's lead-enriched. And now we can go to number 19. What our goal here, or what we did in the wetland here, was to put a cap on top of these contaminated tailings. And you're looking at this picture and you're saying, I don't know how to tell you this, lady, but that is questionable whether it looks better, or one might say it looks worse than it did when you started. The cap that we put on here was from biofouls compost from the city of Coeur d'Alene, as well as from a couple of municipalities in Montana, and we used wood ash. Wood ash has a high lime material and also a high mineral content. And we spread this over the top of the tailings. You can see on the right-hand portion there's an elevated section. We ended up building a road with woody debris so that we would have access to the site. During the excavation, some of you guys, I'm sure most of you guys know the big cat wagons used in mining. It was used, there was a cat wagon in here that was used to take away the upper material that had been excavated, and the tailings were like quicksand, and this cat wagon started sinking down and had to be pulled out once it was up to the window. So I had a great deal of, I was a little nervous here about whether our equipment would be sinking down, but using woody debris and road building fabric underneath, we had no problems driving into this area, even as the water and the site kept filling up. And if you go to the next site, the next slide on slide number 20, here's some more detail about why we went with the compost and the wood ash. What we were trying to do here is build a very healthy wetland muck, a wetland high organic matter soil, and put it on top of the contaminated sediments. Now, if you're a plant and you have the option of growing in really nice rich stuff that'll give you the nutrients you need, or growing into the lead, zinc, toxic stuff, you're going to want to grow in the nice stuff. So the rooting of the plants is going to restrict itself to the nutrient-rich or high organic matter amendment that we put on the top. What we also were hoping to do here was restore ecological function to the site by making it work as a wetland again. If we could get that site to work as a wetland again, wetlands are known, and if you stuck a shovel into a functioning wetland, you get that rotten egg smell, and you know something's going on there. Either someone had beans for lunch, or something's going on in the wetland. What happens in a wetland is you get reducing conditions, and that gets rid of nitrogen, and that's one of the reasons nitrogen gets out of the water and turns into nitrogen gas in the air, and that's a great thing for water quality. But in this case, for a contaminated system, in addition to getting rid of excess nitrate, what you also can do is take sulfur that's present as sulfate and reduce it to sulfide. And so we had the potential of taking the lead and the zinc in the underlying sediment and reprecipitating them as reduced minerals, like the same thing that you mine. So galena and sphalerite instead of lead and zinc oxides. The solubility or the bioavailability of both of those are much, much lower, the reduced lead minerals and the reduced zinc minerals compared to the oxide minerals. And so by providing the compost on top, we're doing two things. We're providing a physical barrier, and we're hoping to change the chemistry of the wetland to make the stuff underneath less available. So even if a bird dives too deep and eats it, the galena will pass right through the bird system rather than having lead become available and toxic and kill the bird. Okay, if you go to the next slide, 21, here the mixture that we used, one of the deals when you're working in an existing water body, you don't want that water body to turn bright green because you've added too many nutrients to it. Eutrophication is not one of your goals in restoration. So using the biosolids, even a class A biosolids here, would be way too nutrient rich. So here we use the biosolids compost. It's going to have a level of nutrients, but not nearly the immediate availability that some of your amendments like a manure or a biosolids would have. It's going to be very high in organic matter, so you're going to recreate a wetland muck, which is the kind of soil you want in a wetland. It's also going to provide food for the microbes. Using the wood ash We got mineral material because you don't want all organic. Also, we got the pH to come way up. And finally, we used the woody material, the really coarse woody debris that we got from a local lumber mill. It's adding a high carbon material further decreases the chances of having too much nitrogen in the system because the carbon will bind up the nitrogen. And finally, we were able to use that to build a road. So this is a road that you can build and leave in place. It's an organic matter road. If you go now to slide number 22, you can see what the different materials we used look like. Wood ash, it's a dark granular material from the particular plant. We got it from Avista Utilities where they burn wood for energy. We got an award from Washington State Business for this project, actually. Biosolids compost, you can see my joy in holding the compost there. And the wood waste, you can see how coarse it is. And this is what we use for the mixture. Going down to the next slide, you can see the area of the swamp that we treated. A portion we were able to apply with a dozer. Where we put the wood waste road, you can see it's kind of a semicircle. We were able to, from that road, with a throw spreader similar to what you saw at the hillside and bunker, use that to throw the compost. However, in order to get to the inside part of the swamp, we also had to go and use a blower system to get the remainder of the compost in there. And then if you go to number 24, you can see Dan driving the dozer. You can see how rich the amendment mixture looks compared to the soil on the surface. Using a dozer, using a fairly simplistic system, application system like this, is going to be by far your cheapest option. It's not always a feasible option. But doing it, you know, pushing and spreading is a great way to do things. Going now to number 25, you can see the air spread throwing the material on the road that we built. This is going to be more expensive, a little more time consuming than the dozer in the distance there. But when you got a chance of sinking that dozer through how many meters of the mine waste material, the aerostat is a lovely, lovely alternative and also very effective. Go now to number 26, and here you can see the blower being used. The blower, this guy isn't going to sink. He's wearing good hip boots. This is going to be your most expensive application technique in this kind of system. However, this is going to let you reach areas that you couldn't reach using the larger machinery. And this is a technology that exists, it's pre-existing. You don't have to invent a thing here. Okay, if you go down to number 27, and here it should be noted that we maybe planted 20 plants, and those were for experimental sampling purposes. You can see without any seeding, just because there was a vegetated area and we had created the good soil that was capable of sustaining an ecosystem, boy, did that ecosystem come fast. The amendment went in, I don't remember, 97, 98. You can see what it looked like in 2001, and a few slides down you'll see what it looked like this last August. But again, before and after, you got no problem here seeing a treatment effect. The statistics on the site were very, very easy to do. Go down to number 28. You can see Chuck again, and you can see just how tall the reeds grew in the site, the Sagittaria, which is one of the native species that the site grew. So, again, you fix the soil, and it's amazing what kind of results you can get. And I should just let you know that it is now snowing in Seattle, so which is not very normal. In terms of, I have a big window in my office, so now you know that. Anyway, in terms of, yes, we made it look pretty, but what have we done to the safety of the materials? Look at the slide number 29, and you can see plant lead in the few plants that were growing. We've made it very attractive. Have we made it into an attractive nuisance? If you look at the lead concentrations in plant tissue, you can see that they've dropped down in for both the arrowhead and the cattail species. So animals eating the plants, not a concern at this point. The same thing is true for cadmium and zinc. which you can see in slide 30, same two species. And if I had put this on a log scale, it might have looked more dramatic. You can just see that we're way down on both cadmium and zinc in for both plant species. You can go to slide 31 and look at what it looks like now and see what the soil looks like now. But let me also tell you that in addition to looking at the plant material, what we did is Harry worked with Mark Springer, who is in the same office there in ERT, and did a range of toxicology testing. Found minnow survival was way up. We also looked at in vitro extractable lead, which is a test to see if the lead will be absorbed in a human gastric system. We saw large decreases in that as well, and we also looked at SEM-AVS, which is another tool for looking at metal availability in a wetlands environment. This we did on the greenhouse version of the study, and we saw dramatic decreases in that as well. In this last August, went back to the site, and the cores that we took were recently run. I don't have the results yet, but they were run by Kirk Shekel, who's at EPA in Cincinnati, and he was running them on a machine called an X-ray absorption spectrophotometer at Argonne National Labs. And what he can do with that machine is basically look at the mineralogy of the lead, see if in the underlying layer, and you can see I have two blue lines in that soil core, we can see then if under the compost we have in the field situation, we were able to do it in the lab, to turn the lead oxides back into lead sulfide. We can see now what's happened in the field 7 years after the amendment addition. If you look at the soil core that we took, which is on the lower left-hand side of the picture, that black thick surface is the compost barrier that we put on, and this is a number of years after. So in addition to the material we put on, plant growth, roots dying, plants growing have added to that layer. You can look at, we took samples from directly below that, and then we took them from even further down below that, and you can see the core split here. The red in that core, that's a sign of oxidation. So we've, from the looks of it, we had reduced the metals right under the compost layer, but you can see that well below that you still have oxidized sediment. This is over a foot in depth here where you get the oxidized sediment, so even a very aggressive and skilled bird is going to have a hard time getting to that, and so what we're doing is hoping that the metals directly under the compost are less available. And here you can see in the top picture on the right, you can see what the wetland looked like however many years it's been since we treated it. It looks gorgeous. There's, okay, I'm on my version of the PowerPoint, so if you go to slide 32, Harry, can you tell me what slide 32 is?
It's a picture of the front cover of the white paper.
Great, okay, that's what I have also. This is one of the resources that's available that discusses approaches to doing this. If you go to that same website, but at the end, instead of white papers, type in compost manual, so after the CLH, compostmanual.pdf, you'll get a newer publication that is going to have an official EPA number that's also a guide to how one goes about doing these things. And so this is pictures of Bunker Hill and also pictures of Jim Ryan and Rufus Cheney, who have both contributed enormously to these projects. And now I'm going to take a breath and go on my computer to the next portion of the presentation, which has Harry's name on it.
Thanks, Sally. Yeah, this is Jeff Heimerman. I think it would be a good time to open it up to some questions.
Fine, buddy.
Give a break, grab a drink of water. We have a few questions on the Internet, but before we go there, I'd like to open it up to the phone lines. So if anybody has a question for Sally or Harry to this point, please feel free to take your phones off mute and ask your question. What we do ask of you, though, is to identify yourself and where you're calling from.
Sally, this is Jim McNamara, State of Georgia Environmental Protection Division.
Hi.
We have a couple of sites here, one in particular, an NPL site,
mm-hmm.
in coastal estuarine environment,
mm-hmm.
where the majority of the contamination is mercury.
Mm.
And one of the things we're running into, at least I'm running into, and maybe you can shed a little bit of light on this, is when you start looking at the whole ABS models and sulfate models and anaerobic and mm-hmm. redoing these wetlands, you also start bumping up against the whole sulfate-reducing bacteria reaction with cinnabar to methylate mercury.
And you don't want to methylate mercury.
Exactly. And what I'm running into is the consultants are coming by with these ABS models that cover the lead, the cadmium, and all that, and they're trying to extrapolate to the mercury. And I'm wondering if there's anything out there that addresses this sort of thing more specifically to mercury. I realize there's a lot more lead and cadmium problems, but not in Georgia.
Yeah, the deal with mercury is that the form of mercury you're going to be really concerned about is methylated mercury.
Definitely.
And the environment that mercury is going to methylate is very often going to be a reducing environment like what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so a solution like we've done here is going to, like I said, work great for your lead and zinc, and it's going to potentially exacerbate your mercury problem.
Do you know of anything?
Do I know of anything? No. I know that Rich Meager has worked with, there's a couple of people working with different plants to change, that can take up mercury into plant tissue and volatilize the mercury.
We prefer not to do that.
Yeah.
The EPA work group guy from Indiana calls, plants that do that, he calls them little green incinerators.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're prettier to look at.
Well, that's true, too, but, you're still breathing it.
Yes.
And that's M-E-A-G-H-E-R, right?
I think so.
Okay.
I can find out.
I think I've talked with him.
Yes. There's another site. There was a site in, where was it? Where's
the Bay down in Texas?
No, it's not an estuary. It's a river system right near the Savannah River, the one in Tennessee.
Oak Ridge. Yeah, it's a lot of work being done up at Oak Ridge because of the mercury that they've dumped there, too.
And there was a community that did a lot of research into a very highly mercury-contaminated system, basically saying it's okay to leave it here.
Yeah, we're getting that, too, but...
That's something you may want to look at. I would be, depending on the levels of mercury and the... who you're considering as potentially at risk, I would be nervous about the mercury.
Well, we're real nervous about it, and the problem is anything invasive is hideously expensive, and the concept of leaving it there, again, it's coastal, potential for impact from storms, from mercury, from hurricanes, and there's this 7-foot tidal flushing there, too.
Yeah.
So we're just kind of wondering if there's, I'm trying to get a little info on whether there's an easier way out or if we're going to continue banging heads here.
All I can give you is the sound of my head banging. I'm sorry.
Well, it'll echo mine. That's all right. Thank you.
Anybody else? Be brave. Okay. I don't hear anything. Any internet questions then? I can't see the internet questions. Could somebody tell me if there's a question to be...
Yeah, Sally, this is Scott. There's actually
Hi, Scott. A
couple of internet questions. One was from Anthony Esposito. He was asking, how did you determine that 17 cubic meters of compost would be adequate?
It wasn't 17 cubic meters, and I think that was the depth we were trying to get, which is about 6 inches. Looking at what a normal rooting zone is. You're trying to balance here the cost of what you're putting down versus depth that's going to be sufficiently protective. This 6 inches is a standard rooting depth. It should have been, we were looking at something that was sufficient, but that wouldn't go over the top, and so that was where we came up with the 15 centimeter depth.
Also, this is Harry Compton. It had to do with the birds and how much...
How deep they go.
How deep they'd stick their nose in the sediment.
Yeah, they're going to want to go where the roots are, because that's going to be where there's something for them to eat, and so you want to do something that's going to be a rooting depth for the plant species that we're talking about.
Great, that clearly was 17 centimeters then, okay. Another question was, what was the thickness of coverage of the treatments in the wetland area? And I guess you could look at that either by looking at the amount of volume put in or the depth. And you obviously were going for depth.
Yeah, we were going for depth. And one of the things on a site like that is you can have a goal of getting an even coverage. And we did all right the first time, went back with the blower system and improved with that. Things are going to move in a wetland and they're going to settle. Having gone back this summer and taken samples, the depth of coverage ranged from, and I'm going to use U.S., from a foot to about 2 to 3 inches across transect across the wetland. So you want to have a goal, realizing that particularly in a wetland system, it's going to be harder to control your precise depth of application, and so you want to have your errors be within an acceptable range.
Great. There's another good question here submitted by Lisa McIntosh, which looks like, it says, adding amendments such as wood ash and biosolids, they obviously improve conditions, but wouldn't they also be introducing new contaminants such as PAHs, metals, etc.?
Yeah, we will address that a little at the very end of the talk, but realize when you're working with biosolids, you're working with something that's been very, very well studied and regulated. And in using residuals, you can very often identify a compound that you might be concerned of. Things, detection limits are low enough, so you may find PAHs in compost. You can also find PAHs in walnut shells. You have to realize that just because you can detect something, it's not necessarily there at a level that's cause for concern. We'll discuss this at the very end of the seminar, but that's a good point and something that we're aware of. Was that an okay answer, Harry, or you got something to add to that?
No, I think you addressed it later on in the the metals issue. I mean, we're looking at mining sites here in these particular case studies where, if you saw the slide on the original concentration, we're talking 3% lead and 1.5% zinc. I mean, these are phenomenal.
And our compost that we're adding has maybe 120 lead, 150 lead. Wood ash doesn't have really detectable lead. Biosolids, national average on lead. The requirements are that it be under 300, and you'll see later on what metals and biosolids are today. So.
Okay. Now, there was another question from Julie Gott from the U.S. Forest Service about how thick was the compost layer at Bunker Hill and how did you determine it. I think we've already answered that pretty clearly, that you were dealing with the wetland area. You were looking at a way to protect the waterfowl who are feeding on tubers, so you had to be able to get down to a depth that would protect them. And you talk about thicknesses and amounts of a residual to be applied at other sites later in your talk. So.
Yeah, and also in the compost paper and the white paper, there's a lot of information in both of those about different rates of application. In the lead bill, you'll hear Harry talk about different rates as well.
Okay, are there any more questions from folks on the telephone?
This is Ray Bogardis at CH2M Hill in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the composition of the plant community and the composition of the critters that are occupying these reconstructed wetlands, have we looked at them long enough to see what kind of successions might be occurring and whether, in fact, we are getting the kind of function that we'd expect over the long term?
We have more data on that at the Leadville site, and that should address your questions there in the wetland site. Dan Audette from Fish and Wildlife has done plant surveys there, and we have information on different plant successional species, and it's looking pretty good, and I can give you his contact information.
Okay.
In terms of critters, there's been a whole lot of work done on the Leadville site and also at another site that I'm not going to go into detail with, but in Jasper County, Missouri, what you see at both of those sites is they come back fast and furious, and it's not exactly what you want, but it's getting to a point of what you want.
Thank you.
Any more questions from the phone?
Thanks for doing that, Scott.
Okay, I think there was one last question I think I'll just bring up on the internet, and it was it's related to what you just talked about, and I think you're going to cover it again, but I'd like to just go ahead and mention it. It's from Corwin Chamberlain with the Virginia DEQ in Glen Allen, Virginia, and it says, do you plan on reapplying over time, or do you believe that the system will stabilize at a level that continues to protect wildlife?
What we've seen to date, and this is not just this site but at other sites, is that the single application seems to be doing it, and I don't have 100 years of data. One of the older sites is Palmerton, Pennsylvania. That site is 15 to 20 years old, and it's looking good now. Another site in Poland, they had really nasty contamination. Single application seems to be doing it. One of the deals with the residuals is you can use them in sufficient quantities, and if you get your blend right, one application seems to do it. If you look at some of the older sites in Pennsylvania and in Virginia with coal mine wastes, and Bob Bastian, who's also an EPA different division, has gone back to a lot of these sites 40 years later. And if you look at one of the sites that the city of Chicago used for their biosolids Fulton County strip mines, they're still growing soybeans on these sites, and there's still forests on these sites. So it would appear that the one shot, if you get it right, is then you come in your wave.
This is Al Westerman with Kentucky DEP, and I had a question that's somewhat been touched on already, but what about the pulp mill having, at least that, whatever you're using to amend the soil, having dioxins and...
Yeah, the dioxins were largely the result of the bleaching processes that they used to use. And you don't have that because of the potential for dioxins, the pulp mills have gone away from that bleaching process. When I talked, remember I talked about the football players and asking them if they'd been to the bathroom yet? That was in a introduction to pulp and paper science class. We have a pulp science division here. And I talked about dioxins and how a lot of the pulp mills have data on dioxins. The primary professor for that class is a pulp and paper scientist, and he looked at me like afterwards, he said, what are you talking about that dioxins for? Nobody uses that bleaching anymore. So you're not going to find them because the pulp industry is very, very sensitive to them, and they will have data on that. The other thing to realize is the one cases where you will potentially have dioxins is where the wood is brought through salt water because they can pick up chloride in salt water. And so then you can have dioxins from burning, from the combustion of the wood with some chloride from the residual salt water. But by and large, it's not an issue.
In a similar strain, what about the pharmaceuticals through the biosolids?
Yeah, pharmaceuticals in the biosolids, there's pharmaceuticals are going to be a much bigger issue for manures because especially if the animals are in confined feeding operations. There's a number of papers out there on pharmaceuticals, and for antibiotics, for example, manures are going to be a big issue there. The pharmaceuticals, in terms of the biosolids, the estrogen you're going to find there is from birth control pills. There's a guy in Canada named Ed Topp that's looking at decomposition of hormonal compounds in biosolids and manures. What he's seen is in an aerobic environment, the hormones are gone within about 48 hours. Certain other pharmaceuticals, and I think Valium is one, will persist for a much longer period. The question is, and I don't have an answer to this, in a marine environment like a wetland, these compounds, these endocrine disrupting compounds, if they go into solution, they can cause problems. So then you have a question of a trade-off. Do you, and you have to look at the wetland beforehand and the wetland after. Are you, you obviously have a whole lot of good there. Is the potential risk from endocrine disrupting compounds going to be sufficient to negate that good? With a composted material, a lot of those compounds are going to be destroyed in the composting process. Now, in an aerobic environment, like a regular soil environment, most of the risk from those compounds that we understand has been in water systems. In a soil system, are they going to pose the same kind of risks? And the thought is looking at the different potential pathways that they're not, but there's a lot of ongoing research. I know that we have a study in the greenhouse right now looking what happens to nonylphenols, which are a type of detergent that are in biosolids, looking at how fast they degrade in soil where you're growing wheat. And we did the 30-day harvest, haven't done the plant analysis. There's a lot of work going on about this stuff now, and I'm sorry I was so wordy in my answer.
Yeah, this is Scott Fredericks. I'd like to acknowledge that there are a few more questions on the Internet, and we will try to address them. But I'd like to see if we could go ahead and continue on with the presentation so that we can get through them before the end of our period. So I'm not sure, Sally or Harry, who's on deck right now, but if you can just pick it up in whatever slide you were on.
Okay, everyone should be on slide 34. And the next case study I'm going to talk about is another mining site, but it's a different environmental niche. In fact, it's a rather unique environmental niche. This is in Leadville, Colorado. It's along the Upper Arkansas River. And what the slide depicts are some metal salts that have wicked to the surface, because this site is out in Colorado, and it's where evaporation exceeds precipitation, and so you get the metal salts wicking to the surface in these arid areas. Now, Leadville, aside from being a very interesting area, it exists at 10,200 feet, the highest elevated incorporated town in North America. It gets about 16 inches of rain a year, and the growing season is approximately 60 days. So, growing anything here is rather difficult. It's an extreme kind of environment. And then when you add to it the complication of these fluvial deposits along the river, it makes it very difficult to try and remediate this area. So the site itself, or the operable unit that we're looking at here along the Upper Arkansas River, the history is that the California Gulch mining operations that took place in Leadville had, over the course of 80 or 100 years or so of mining, had these basically mine earthen dam blowouts. And so for an 11-mile stretch of the river, there were these anywhere from a half-acre to two-acre deposits, fluvial deposits of mine tailings. So these tailings are rich in lead, zinc, and cadmium, and subsequently these were always denuded. They were no one could ever grow anything there, and during the episodic ups and downs of the Upper Arkansas River from the releases from the upstream reservoirs, because the tailings typically didn't have any soil structure whatsoever, it would calve and slough off into the river, and we'd get fish kills. Aside from the loss of land use here.
Yeah, I think slide 35 shows you the side of the river that will allow, that kind of depicts what that calving looks like.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I'm on with slide 35. So we have the toxicity through the vegetation because of the zinc concentrations. A lot of the soils are pyritic in nature. So you would get oxidation of the iron sulfide to sulfuric acid, basically, so you'd end up with pools of pH 2, not uncommon, around the Leadville area. Okay, let's move on to slide 36. So the
The risks were the re-entrainment of the tailings to the river system. That was a big concern. And the fact with the episodic ups and downs of the rivers I had mentioned being re-exposed and basically having the fish killed. On the other, the tailings themselves posing a risk to the upland system through terrestrial systems. Okay, let's move on to slide 37. Okay, so here we have the soil system with the tailings themselves. And what would happen was with the pyritic tailings that were highly acidic from the iron sulfide and the fluctuating water table, it gave the capillary rise of these metal salts that would wick to the surface that we had in that first slide for this site. And so the insufficient rainfall, not that it's insufficient for that area, but because that area only got 16 inches of rainfall, the reduced metals, they would be oxidized, so they would pose a greater risk. You get the wicking to the surface, and then you get the salt crust. Okay, slide 38. So in Leadville, and back in, this originally took place in back in 1998 when the OSC and RPM approached me and asked for a solution other than digging and hauling or trying to excavate these approximately 150 fluvial deposits, tailings deposits along an 11-mile stretch of river. They said they asked for a different kind of solution. So that's when Sally and Rufus Cheney from USDA, that we got together and put together a plan. So the biosolids and lime amendment here will increase subsoil and surface pH, increase the organic matter at the surface to reduce that wicking effect or that capillary rise of the metal salts, and actually precipitate the metals in solution on the iron and manganese oxides that are in the biosolids. You get an increase in microbial activity, increasing potential reductions, sulfide precipitation. Back going back to what Sally was talking about and her wetland example, getting galena formation. And these two mechanisms reduce the metal availability. Let's move on to slide 39. So, we engaged Denver Metro Wastewater Treatment Authority. Now, Denver itself was, because Leadville itself, even though they have a high-quality product, didn't have the volume for the large area that we're talking about here at this site. So Denver was about 100 miles away, and so the Denver Metro Wastewater Treatment Authority was happy to help us out here. I think the material was free, but we had to pay for the transportation and the union. The truckers weren't used to driving over the mountains. They were used to delivering on the nice flatlands, the farmlands. So that was a bit of a challenge. So Sally and her colleagues came up with an application rate for given the acid potential from the pyritic soils and the metal toxicities. And they came up with an application rate of about 100 dry tons of biosolids per acre and about 100 tons of lime per acre, which worked out to be about 250 wet tons. Correct me if I'm wrong, Sally.
More than that. Knee deep.
So we were a pretty thick layer of
goo.
Goo, yeah. Moving on to slide number 40. So we mixed the biosolids with some agricultural lime at about that application rate, up 250 wet tons and 100 dry tons of lime. And this stuff, as it came off the trucks, was like this thick black pudding of e-biosolids. And it was interesting material to work with. It has great cohesive properties. So they mixed it as best they could using the loaders. Then, on slide 41, they loaded it up into a carrier, which is a sort of aero spreader of sorts, and it had a little spreader on the back, like a whirlybird broadcaster on the back of that spreader. And so it ended up being about a foot thick of this material of biosolids and lime, this thick cake. And then to get better mixing or incorporation into the tailings themselves, we wanted to get better mixing so we would have more treatment of the metals. We tried using discers and so on being pulled by dozers, but they ended up just kind of skating across the top of this material. I think we finally ended up using just a tooth ripper. It wasn't the best of all worlds, and when you're trying to mix this treatment media, this treatment amendment into the soils, but it actually ended up working pretty well. All right, feel free to jump in.
One thing to add is that the Terragator and the Loaders Denver Metro provided those, and that was in-house equipment for them.
Okay, so on the slide number 42, we have a kind of a before and after shot here. Now, the OSC on this project that was the lead on this operable unit for this Superfund site, before we did the treatment on those different fluvial deposit areas, he would stabilize the stream banks using both hard and soft structure. So he used rock in a combination with willow wattles and other things because we didn't want to lose all that treatment, all that effort, level of effort and amendment that we put into those tailings deposits to another rise in the river. So in order to, he reinforced and stabilized the stream bank. And then we went back and treated, amended the area.
We used compost right next to the river. So again, we wouldn't have the potential to hurt the water quality with excess nutrients. And then the biosolids were used on the fields once you got, I think it was 20 feet from the river. There was I don't remember exactly, 20 or 30 foot setback.
Right, that's part of the 503 land application regulations. I think it's a 10 meter setback, so we had to use compost that are less nutrient-rich kind of materials next to the water body there. And now then we have Sally outstanding in the field, who relatively newly amended area, and it's lush and green. I can't remember. This looks like one of the perennial rye or annual rye seeded areas.
Yeah, you'll see pictures from last summer at the end of this.
Yeah, lush. Slide 43, and here we have a before and after of the metal salts wicking to the surface. And this area of the cows being pastured here, there's one landowner in particular here, Dr. Bernie Smith, who was a retired veterinarian who had been basically wrestling with the mining companies for his entire life. And this is an elderly gentleman, and he well into his 80s, and so he was thrilled to death that he could actually use this land that was barren and unusable for his entire life. Well, basically his entire life he was been fighting with a mining company. So this was one very happy landowner that within a year or two of application that it was fertile enough and rich enough that he could plant, not like get things to grow, but he could graze his cattle.
Yeah, there's a picture of Bernie later on. So.
Okay, on the slide 44. Now, Mark Springer from our office helped us looking at performance measures or technical performance measures. I mean, how do we measure success at sites like this? And this is something that comes up at virtually every site because many site managers are only looking at total contaminant concentrations. So we obviously, since we're leaving the contaminant in place, but we're reducing the bioavailability and leachability and mobility of these metals, we wanted a different way of looking at measures of success. So I asked Mark to help me out developing the kind of eco-risk measures as measures of success at these kinds of sites. So at Leadville, and work that he had done with actually Scott Fredericks, your moderator, at Jasper County, and some other work that was done at Palmerton, we're kind of fine-tuning. We're not quite there yet with coming up with a definitive list of measures, but this eco-risk way of looking at things. It seems like a better way to go than total contaminant concentration.
And also, we're going to come on the results from Leadville, but the question about whether it is safe and what's happening with the plants and the animals, we'll give you results from Leadville, but know that the results from these other sites have been remarkably similar to what we've seen at Leadville.
Okay, on to slide 45. So starting from the very basics and working our way up the food chain, Mark wanted to look at the microbial function in the soil. The soil functionality, essentially. So what we're looking at as far as the first level there are the tailings. Those are the untreated tailings. Those are the tailings themselves that had very little to no growth in them. And we're going to compare that to the upstream control, which was a pristine kind of area. And then the biosolids amended tailings. So if we're just looking at the respiration of the carbon dioxide, see there, you can see that there's a lot more respiration going on in the tailings, or in the biosolid amended tailings than the tailings themselves, and significantly more than the upstream control. So we obviously have some microbial functionality there. And part of it's because we added so much organic matter into that soil horizon there. So we're kind of getting this flush of new growth of in the microbial world there.
Then can I do the nitrate one?
Yeah, sure.
One of the others, they're eating, but do you have a diverse group of microbes there? And one way to look at that or look for that is to see if you have enough microbes there that they can carry out the nitrogen cycle. Can they take the organic nitrogen, turn it into ammonia, and then turn it into nitrate? Because if they're eating, that's great, that's one thing, but you want to make sure that they're recycling the nutrients so you don't have to come back. And a way to look at that is to look at the ratio of nitrate to ammonia, because it's a microbial transformation to get from ammonia to nitrate. So what you want there is a number that's bigger than 1, because the number bigger than 1 says that the microbes are functioning in the nitrogen cycle as well. In the tailings, you can see that, in fact, no, they're not doing a thing with that transformation. The microbes responsible for that are not there. They're not present. They're not doing their jobs. But in both the pristine area and in the biosolids amended area, you have a ratio greater than 1 saying, okay, we are recycling those nutrients. We do have microbial activity that is functioning well for this important cycle. That's all I have to say on that.
Okay. On to slide 46. Okay. Now, we also did an earthworm study here, earthworm toxicity. And if you look at the tailings themselves, the survival was absolutely none. I mean, not one worm lived. I mean, they all died, and apparently they all died in relatively short amount of time relative to the study. And subsequently, there's no biomass because none of the worms lived. But what we can do is look at compare the biosolid amended tailings to the upstream control. And this is the pristine control that I mentioned earlier. And you can see if we look at the survivability, that the biosolids amended tailings are certainly on par with the upstream control at 89% plus or minus 3. And the interesting thing, if we look at the biomass there, you can see that the biosolids amended tailings, because they're so rich in organic matter, actually had quite a bit more biomass than the upstream control. So the worms were
fatter.
Fat and happy worms in this study. Okay, on to slide 46. Almost the same thing for ryegrass. We did this ryegrass study looking at survival. The tailings, there was absolutely no survival whatsoever. And this is the untreated tailings. And the treated tailings, we had 95% survivability and very comparable to the control, 98%. So we're pretty happy with those results on the ryegrass.
Can I do the next one? Because I was told this was too confusing.
Okay.
Then
slide 48?
Yeah.
Okay.
The next question is it back to a normal system? And here we are, all the pretty colors and different colored bars are just the different types of plant species. And do we have the diversity that we were hopefully trying to get? And you can look at the first two with all the different colors as the goal. And you can see in the biosolids as of 2000, we're not quite up to that goal yet. We have a whole lot more in that dark green bar, which is the grass species. You'll see later on what the species diversity looked like on small research plots that we had this summer, and you'll see that we're getting towards that diversity that we were looking for. But early on, your biosolids are very rich in nitrogen, and the grass species are going to dominate because of that.
Right. Yeah, well, the other reason is that we planted lots of ryegrass.
Mm-hmm.
And largely a monoculture, and we did try and plant native plant species, but that was on a smaller number of plots there.
Yes.
So that's another reason it was dominated by the grass species there.
Okay.
Okay, but the interesting thing, we still had a lot of biomass.
Huge, yeah.
Okay. Slide number 49. So on to the small mammals. Mark Springer did the small mammal trapping, and to look at the body burden due to the metal uptake of eating plants and varmints that lived in the soil, and looked at concentrations in specific organs. I think specifically kidneys, right? If I recall.
Yeah, here at Leadville he did whole body burden. At Jasper County he did liver and kidney. And looking for lesions, because if you have too much metal in the system, too much cadmium or lead, you start getting renal and liver and kidney dysfunction. And here, whole body burden, no, we were all within limits. And in Jasper County, looking at the target organs themselves, they can pee as much as they want. Their kidneys are working just fine.
Yeah, as I recall, Mark said there was a histological change. Kidneys, but they weren't detrimental to the functionality.
Mm-hmm.
So they were,
and only occasional.
They could see changes due, I guess, to the cadmium. And so actually we should go on to slide 50 because it talks a little bit about the pathway, the herbivore pathway that ingests things that are grown on contaminated soils, where the herbivores eating the grass or the seeds from the grass versus the carnivore pathway, specifically shrews eating worms. And actually at Jasper, I guess, that was the primary cleanup measure or risk evaluator, right, was the shrews eating
mm-hmm.
worms.
Mm-hmm. That's going to be in a lot of sites the case.
Moving on to slide 51. Now this is back to Colorado, the Upper Arkansas River. One of the questions that we got asked repeatedly at meetings with their core group or their representative, kind of a stakeholder group there, when we were discussing the pros and cons and options with the biosolids, is what happens if the biosolids amended tailings? Yes, sure, we can pass leach tests like TCLP and SPLP and multiple extraction procedure and pass these tests. But what happens if these tailings, treated tailings, end up being re-entrained into the river due to some unanticipated flood event? What will the metals become available and fill the fish again? And so we did that study, or actually Mark Springer had done the study, looking at a re-entrainment study. And so the control is a healthy soil that has no metals concentration.
You should go to the next slide.
Oh, yeah. Oh, 52. So I'm sorry. You're right. Slide 52. And anyway, you can see compared to the treated tailings, and we actually had very good survivability. So this is biosolids amended tailings that are basically have bound up the metal that are re-entrained, and then did this patted minnow study. And then versus the untreated tailings. So the untreated tailings obviously have a huge impact on the aquatic life. Either not much survivability. Okay, on to slide 53.
Can I take over here?
Sure.
Okay. I went back to sample again in August. So this is of 7 years after the original amendment, and you can see in the background that field where the salts had been in an earlier picture this year, Doc Smith doesn't have cows grazing in the field, and the grass is up to my waist. And in the lower picture, you can see Doc Smith and Mike Zimmerman, who is the OSC for the picture. And I was out there in the field with him, and Doc and Mike were having a fight about how you can tell what measures should be used for productivity, because they want these fields, they want to make sure that they're getting productivity from the fields, like the fields that hadn't been contaminated at all. And they're talking about hay yields in the fields. And I pointed out, Doc Smith, who hadn't seen a thing grow in his fields for over 70 years, is now fighting over how to gauge optimal yields from these fields, and so things are pretty good. And they agreed that it was very nice to be having this kind of argument, and that this was fine by them. If you go to the next slide, you can see one of the areas that we worked on is now a public park in the area. And we tried here different methods of seeding to get a native system restored. One of the things that we used was just hay from native plants, and that would provide a mulch as well as a seed source. And the two little pictures, one is a wild aster, and the other is a gooseberry, which is native there, and both of these were just volunteers on the native plots. You can see in the bigger picture, by the different coloration and the size of the different species, that we are starting to get the species diversity that we were looking for. And if you go to the next slide, from the samples that I took this summer, I was looking at metal concentration in the plant tissue, because that's a sign if you're really successful, and also looking at the different species in the small-scale field plots that we had established. Here's a list of the different species that we found in the range of the plots, and you can see that we're getting fairly diverse, which is fabulous. And also the plant zinc concentrations, we're not at a range that suggests toxicity to the plants. Most of these numbers, 80 was the low, 500 was the high. For most of these, we were in a range of about 1 to 200, which is exactly where you want to be. So this was great to see. Finally, if you go to the next slide, years back, we had been asked to put in kiosks. And we have a kiosk at Doc Smith's property by the research plots, and also in this area that had been turned into a park. And there are two kiosks in the park area, and when we first went there, we put in posters in the kiosks explaining the toxicity of the metals and the mine tailings, where they came from, and the amendment that we're using and what we're trying to do. I went back this summer, and I thought, you know, this has really worked, because we have made ourselves completely a thing of the past. Those posters on the mine tailings are out, and now what's in the kiosks is alpine ecosystems. As you get higher in elevation, the plants get smaller. So there's not a mention now on the kiosks that you're looking at something that used to be an MPL site. Now it's what kind of fish you're going to find and what kind of alpine vegetation you're going to find. And a little thing like that, to me, was a sign that we've done our job well. And then we're coming to the last part, which was addressing a question earlier. And do you want to talk, Harry, or you want me to talk?
Go ahead. Why don't you talk, and I'll do the color commentary if I think of something.
Okay. Okay. So hopefully we've convinced you with these case studies that this is potentially a great way to go. Every road can have a bump, and so I wanted to address some of the potential bumps here. When you're working with residuals generators, the waste that they generate is, to them, in most cases, still a waste. And you're coming to them saying, you want this waste. So they're not necessarily going to right away understand how to work with you. So when you try and get some of these residuals, you have to be a little patient and a little understanding, and realize that these guys are not used to somebody calling up and saying, I want 200 tons, can you deliver them Thursday? So it's a process, and just have a little extra patience and understanding, and you'll get a really true blue friend here, and it can work out great with everyone. Then there's also, and this relates to the question, when you're working with residuals, they can have stuff in them, and very often there's still a perception that they can contain toxic levels of different contaminants. If you go to the next slide, which is 58, is that right?
58, correct.
Okay. There's a bunch of reasons that you can take that concern and put it to rest. You have a history of success now. We've worked on a number of sites. We've done a range of testing on these sites, and that gives you some level of comfort. In addition to that, with the residuals themselves, for a lot of these residuals, particularly the biosolids, also with the wood ash, there is a lot of research that has been done on these materials. There are laws governing the use of the materials. And what the research has shown for the biosolids is metals in biosolids, amended soils, are less available than metals in unamended soils. Finally, the thing that to me is the most comforting is that along with the regulations on biosolids quality, for biosolids you also had the pretreatment regs coming into effect. So whereas in the 80s, before the pretreatment regs, industries were not restricted on what they could put into the municipal wastewater system, now there are pretreatment regulations that say, hey, we have limits on what you can put into this system, and municipalities have basically source control divisions or pretreatment police. And the pretreatment in the Seattle Metro wastewater treatment nailed, shall I say, an aircraft manufacturer in the area because they detected excess chromium in this system, and they were able to narrow it down to Boeing, and they got huge fines at Boeing for exceeding their limits on chromium, and they got a lot of bad press in the paper. So if you go, and now I'm ahead of myself here, but if you first look at the studies, what you can see, and here's just one example, and this is coming out of Jim Ryan's lab, Ganga Hetarachichi, and I have a hard time pronouncing her last name, but Ganga is a lovely woman, did a lot of work looking at metal absorption potential in biosolids and found that...
We're on slide 59, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Found that you get metal absorption both from the organic and inorganic fraction of the biosolids. So that's one safety there, and she's one of the people that's published on this. And proof of this is from the Joplin field site, which was a site in the city of Joplin near a lead and zinc smelter. And here we took the high lead soil in the field, amended it with a range of different things, including phosphorus and a high iron compost that had been produced in Washington, D.C., fed it to rats, and what we saw was that the 10% compost was as effective as the 1% pea. In both cases, lead availability to the rats was reduced by about 25%. The 1% pea was then fed to graduate students at Columbia, so think about where you want to send your children to graduate school, at very low levels, so it was safe for them. That was just a bad joke. And reduction of availability in humans of the same treatment that did the same as the compost was about 70%. So we got the biosolids that are potentially really good at trapping metals and published literature about that. And then we have the pretreatment regs. So if you go to the next slide, you can see what the metals and the biosolids have done over the years. This is data from Chicago. Chicago biosolids used to be famous because they were so rich in cadmium, and the Chicago source control police apparently are not anybody you'd want to mess with, because cadmium has gone from over 300 in the Chicago biosolids to about 4. Same deal with lead. You can see the reductions in lead over time. And Chicago is a very productive town. They make about 200,000 dry tons of biosolids per year. So if you're anywhere near Chicago and need a source of very clean materials, you can see just how clean they are. And the next one, do you want to do this, Harry?
62?
Yeah.
Yes, actually, I wanted to talk a little bit about that fact that there are a wide range of sites that these kind of technology is applicable. Not just biocells themselves, but manures and using a wide variety of residuals and various combinations, you can tackle all kinds of sites that may have metal concentration or even low-level pH concentrations. There's a steel site just north of Pittsburgh that I'm hoping to apply this kind of technology, and there they have marginal metal concentrations and very low pH concentrations, and they were one of the topsoil. So rather than steel topsoil from some other area, they said, well, let's manufacture the soil. So they're looking into that. And the advantage of the biosolids over the manures is the fact that not only the pathogen issue and that the biosolids can get much lower pathogen concentration, but also they don't have the iron and manganese oxides same concentration to bind up the metal. So you may need to do some kind of bench scale treatability or some way of evaluating that to make sure that you're definitely tying the metals up.
And it depends on the site you're going to be working on.
Right. At some sites, it may not be an issue. This is a very attractive and inexpensive way for restoration. The lots of positive things are that you partner with local communities in their wastewater treatment systems, and it buys, you buy a lot of credibility when you're using locally supplied material to fix a problem.
Yeah, one thing to be said, at the sites I've worked on, public acceptance has never been an issue. You get such a dramatic before and after, and if you do the homework and say, this is what we're going to do, this is why we're going to do it, and are very upfront about what you're doing, my favorite reaction was one guy in Redville asked how come they couldn't get more of these biosolids. And Harry and Scott says you can attest that that's the case.
No, absolutely.
So.
I thought you were going to make a joke there.
No. I think I'll go to Chicago to get more. Anyway.
The only other thing I want to offer about biosolids, the toxicity issue was, you mentioned the endocrine
disruptors, yeah.
Estrogen and so on. They're more a part of the water-soluble fraction that you don't see in as high a concentrations in the solids material? That's a question for you, Sally.
It depends on the particular compound and this is one of those. There's the big famous USGS paper that came out a couple years ago looking downstream from CAFOs and wastewater treatment plants, and they were able to find detectable levels. I don't know what concentrations in effluent are. Certain compounds, depending on their solubility in water versus hydrophobicity or hydrophilic or hydrophobic, will partition to the solid, so it's going to be a compound-specific thing. I'm sorry, that wasn't the greatest answer. Different things are going to go different ways depending on the nature of the particular compound. So there's no universal answer. There's a whole range of compounds that are now being looked at that have endocrine disrupting properties. There are different hormonal compounds. There are things like nonylphenols, which are detergents. There are things like phthalates, which are plasticizers, polybrominated diphenyl ethers. The things like PBDEs are going to partition very strongly to the solids, to the biosolids, not into the water. A lot of the other endocrine disruptings are going to go into both. I'm babbling, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Why don't we wrap this up?
Yeah, we actually, we are at the end of the formal presentations, but we do have about 5 minutes here to take some questions. I'd like to start with some questions from anybody on the phone. And if we have some time, I'd like to go back to some of the questions we're getting off the Internet, which are very good, too. Anybody on the phone want to ask a question?
everybody's at this point ready to go have lunch or go home.
Okay, a couple of questions off the internet. One here from Scott Davidson is for the earthworm survival. Was this based on earthworms added to soil in a lab, or was this actual field data? It seems Harry suggests it was in the lab, but if so, how much soil was used? I think what we can do is, if someone wants to contact Harry, we can get you the exact protocol for that.
Right, Scott, it was an ASTM earthworm toxicity test. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but I can certainly get it. It's a standardized ASTM test that was performed.
Okay, another question was, when high nitrogen amendments are used, do weeds become a problem, especially when a weed seed bank was present previous to the reclamation work?
Yes. The answer to that is yes. You can do things about that. You can mix the biosolids with a high carbon material like a woody waste, but in Jasper, for example, on one area we used the biosolids, and it was right near an area that had home garden soils that had been excavated. It was a big seed source for ragweed, and we got without seeding, we got a monoculture of ragweed. So in this case, you need to potentially be, depending on what your seed source is nearby, if you have a seed source of a noxious weed, you have the potential to grow a lot of a noxious weed, and you have to come in and be aggressive about seeding what you want and controlling the noxious weeds.
I'd like to just add a comment to that, is that this is one of a series of seminars that we're going to present related to doing sort of jump-starting ecosystem restoration work, but we really do have a couple of executive orders. We really do try very hard to use native plants, and it is one of the most difficult, most frustrating aspects of all this work is trying to get a nice, healthy native plant ecosystem established, and we do run into a lot of problems with these entrained seed banks that are previously existed or that kind of move in. Whenever you do any kind of disturbance of the soils, whether it's with this kind of restoration work or any kind of amendments, these invasive plants are highly opportunistic, and they will move in. And we're going to try to address some of the things that can be done for managing invasives in the future. Another question here is there a soil chemistry reference that will offer suggestions for amendment materials that will bind up metals in the soils and amounts?
The white paper has some information on that, and I can provide a bunch of reprints if somebody would email me and ask.
There's actually a pretty good paper that actually Sally Brown and Mark Springer had written just this past year. It was published in the first quarter for JEQ, Journal of Environmental Quality, and it was the paper made the cover feature article, and it goes into a lot of detail that address some of the questions I might have, and we can provide that as well.
Are there any more questions from anybody on the phone?
Yeah, I had a question about...
Please identify yourself and who you're with, please.
This is Al Westerman from Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
On your toxicity test with the fathead minnows, were those 96 hours, is that what that test was, or did you run this longer than that? Or?
No, it was a 96-hour. Once again, it was a standardized test.
Uh-huh.
Asked me to quote the number, but it was, yeah.
Because I can see some, particularly for some of these metals, not really seeing the effects until more chronic effects as well, rather than acute effects. Do y'all have any plans when you do another one of these to look at longer testing on some of these things, particularly those that are the wetland situations or the ones that are along a stream?
Well, one of the things to realize is that with the amendment, the soils were sloughing off because there was no vegetative cover.
Right.
So you don't have that issue. And anecdotally, in the wetlands in Idaho last year when we were out there. There's a family of river otters that's moved in. There's a whole lot of, anecdotally, I can tell you one thing that's not going to answer your question. Anecdotally, you're not seeing any increased toxicity related to the metals over time. And
I really like this test because it answered a lot of questions. And you're right, we'd like to do this term, but it's a matter of money and time. We went to great lengths to try and show that this is kind of a positive effort. So if you're willing to donate the funding, we'd be happy to do the test.
We're worrying about whether we have a job or not. I noticed that you said something about I've already said this about the invasive species, but that one chart table you had up looked like about most of the species were ones that were invasive that you had appearing. Do you think this is just that what's left over seed from what's been there for a long time, or do you think this
the Leadville?
Half of, or two-thirds of those were introduced species kind of thing.
I was, the guy I was doing the plant species survey with is a guy that has a native seed company, and he seemed very happy with what we were getting. In terms of if you have a the sedge, timothy, alkali grass, tufted hair grass, pearl, palustra, shepherd's purse, yarrow, pineapple weed, all the stuff that was there was stuff that he was happy to find in a meadow in Brazil. It may not be what you'd want if you're grazing cattle there, and I'm going to defer to him because he's going to know the plants better than I would.
Bob, do you have anything to add to that?
Not really. Again, it's been one of our greatest frustrations is we've gone to great lengths to procure seed and try to apply it in a variety of ways. I think the U.S. Forest Service has probably given us some of the best advice in terms of taking some of the native plant seed and using drill seed methods to get the proper kind of contact at the right depth. But whenever we go into an area and we apply these kind of nutrients and amend the soil, if there is a seed bank there that's been there, or and there's going to be stuff that's just going to get blown in by the wind or by birds, it's just very difficult to deal with. And there are things you can do if you're allowed to do controlled burns and that kind of stuff, but that's really kind of the whole, all those mechanisms are really something we want to address sort of separately from this. For purposes of this presentation, we were trying to describe ways you can go into areas that have certain types of metal contaminated soils and how you can remediate them and how you can address that A horizon so that you can reestablish a vegetative cover. And sometimes that vegetative cover, once you get it established, is kind of the largest part of the battle because you've stabilized the surface and you've also put stuff into the soil that's binding a lot of the contaminants of concern. And then slowly over time you can start to address some of the invasive weed problems and try to coax and move your community of vegetation in the direction you want to move. Are there any more questions from the folks on the phone? I think a lot of the other questions in here that I'm getting off of the internet I think have been addressed. There are things like flood events. And that's, again, I think some of the things we've talked about in terms of once you've stabilized the soil surface and you've got a healthy vegetative cover, that goes a long way to keep a lot of the contaminated soils that are beneath that surface from being disturbed if you do have a flood event. There is a question here about from a fellow whose dad, it looks like Christians did, the Virgin Islands. He says, I live and work in a tropical climate. Do you have any eco-restoration projects or case studies that have been undertaken in the tropics? And I don't know if you guys want to handle that.
I'd be happy to start one. It's snowing here now.
Sally, don't you have a project in Costa Rica or something?
Nothing really.
Oh.
I mean, we built composting toilets in Costa Rica.
I would think, though, that the concepts would be similar. It's just you're just working with different plants. And,
mm-hmm.
But in terms of soil health and fertility and tilth and that kind of stuff, we're talking about the same kind of a
yep.
concept and approach. Also, there's going to be at the end of this, you can if you go to the very end of this, there's a bunch of links that we're going to have posted for additional papers and additional places you can go to get additional information, as well as the speaker's contact information, so that you can contact them in the future after this presentation is completed. Are there any more questions from anybody on the phone? Okay, I think we're getting really close here. I could bring up one more question that's listed here is, did the biomass amended material have greater moisture retention properties?
Yep.
And if so, do you think this may be a contributing factor to the support of microbial insects and plants?
Sure.
Sure, yeah, it had about 3 or 4 times the water holding capacity. Actually, we have that data if anybody would like to see it, but not in this slide presentation. But that was a key factor in getting plant growth there because the tailings themselves, because there was no soil structure, when it did rain, they would just blow right through the soil into the groundwater and run off. So the water holding capacity allowed the plants to even get established.
One other question is, in slide 47, was the rye tox test a germination test, or were whole plants planted and observed?
Seeds were planted, and it was in a greenhouse environment. So it was a 10-day test on germination.
And then another question is, what are the best references for us to read if we are considering using biosolids or other residuals in a project, both for our own education as professionals and to convince others of the value of residuals?
There's the white paper listed, and then there's the compost manual that you know about, Scott, that we had on Chuck's website, and then I can provide any number of peer-reviewed publications that are going to be more scientific in nature for those looking for documentation that this works and here's the data.
Yeah, I mean, Jim Ryan's work that he did showing, kind of definitively demonstrating how the metals are actually absorbed onto the biosolids, both with organic matter absorption and iron and manganese oxides. And he didn't even mention the hysteresis effect. I don't think we
mm-hmm.
talked about that, how the metals are easily absorbed but difficult to pull off. That study was really
mm-hmm.
good.
Yeah, and then we had the different studies on the lead amended sites that are very nice as well. Those sites with high lead that have been amended, and you see the lead availability being reduced. I have bunches of reprints from those sites as well.
Okay, another question from Scott Davison, who posted one earlier about cost effectiveness. He just posted another one. Said, they looked at the groundwater leachate from the amended areas.
Yes. USGS was involved in the Leadville site, and in other sites, there's a whole lot of data from coal mine sites. Lee Daniels from Virginia Tech is one person that's done a bunch of stuff looking at groundwater nitrate levels following large-scale applications of biosolids or nitrogen-rich materials. What you see is if you use pure biosolids, you'll get a spike in nitrate concentrations in groundwater. That usually occurs within the first year after application, and the question is if you're willing to tolerate that, and if you're not, what his research has also shown is that if you use a compost or a carbon-rich material in combination with the biosolids, then you can greatly reduce, if not take away, that nitrate spike.
Okay, well, I'd like to just thank very much Dr. Sally Brown, the University of Washington, and Harry Compton with the Environmental Response Team. I hope everybody got something out of this. We would appreciate very much getting your feedback. And I encourage you also to go to our links and to stay tuned for different presentations we're going to make in the future. I have nothing additional to add at this point. If anybody has any comments, we've got about a minute left.